It is Friday, November 29th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. On this day after Thanksgiving edition of Ozarks, we'll hear excerpts from a conversation I had with Pete Early about his book, Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. He was in Fayetteville earlier this month as the featured author of this year's One Book, One Community project that's put together by the University of Arkansas. Then, a pair of visiting singers and songwriters from Nashville, Eric Brace and Peter Cooper. They were in Fayetteville earlier this autumn and played music for us inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio. That's ahead on this new edition of Ozarks at Large. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. And it's time for the KUAF and Friends Holiday Giveaway. This drawing is your chance to win a gift from one of many generous KUAF underwriters. Participants include Certa Pro Painters, the Alma Performing Arts Center, 11, and Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art. Winners will be announced Friday, December 13th, during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Registration and more information available at KUAF.com. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. This month, Pete Early, a former Washington Post reporter, came to the University of Arkansas as this year's featured author in the annual One Book, One Community project. It's a project that invites everybody to read, then discuss an important book. Early was asked to come here to talk about his book, Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. The book follows Pete's real son's battle with mental illness and also takes readers through jails and prisons where people with mental illness are placed when there is seemingly no other alternative. While he was in Fayetteville, Pete Early delivered a public lecture on the U of A campus, met with students and community members, and participated in a forum with me at the Fayetteville Public Library called The Gathering of the Groups. That event invites members of several area book clubs to come listen to the author and take part in a question and answer session. I began our part of the conversation at the library by asking Pete Early about the first word in his Pulitzer-nominated book, that word, crazy.
Well, publishers like one-word titles. And I, at the time I was doing my research, I honestly did not realize how offensive that word is and how stigmatizing it often is to persons who have mental illnesses. So I didn't fight them when they wanted to use the title crazy, but the main reason I didn't fight them was I've always felt, and from the moment I wrote the book, that we were really talking about the system. Unfortunately, it offended an awful lot of groups, and in fact, the NAMI had to kind of put it through its stigma clearinghouse, and Mental Health America actually initially told me that they were not going to back the book or support the book because of the title. And then after they read it, they ended up giving me an award. But it was, I mean, stigma is very, very real to persons who have mental illness. And it's so pervasive. It, you know, it's like, I had covered deinstitutionalization in Oklahoma. I had written stories about our changing mental, I thought I knew a lot about mental health. And then when it happens to you and you realize just how ignorant you are, you're just kind of shocked. And this removed the scales from my eyes. And if you look, a few weeks ago, you'll see all these examples of stigma. A few weeks ago, Dr. Phil, who should know better, said that people who are crazy bark at the moon and eat rocks. Dr. Oz has made comments. Jay Leno constantly makes comments. Even our own president has said at various times, implied that people with mental illness are all violent and dangerous. And that kind of thing just is so stigmatizing that it just wears people down and also causes a lot of damage.
Well, after the nearly 400 pages reading, I still think the four most chilling words in the book are the first four in the book, I had no idea. Yeah. Because when we don't have an idea of what's going on, nothing will change. Yeah. And if a Washington Post reporter has no idea, I mean...
Well, it gets worse than that.
Oh, okay.
Because, look, if you read my book, you realize I tried to get my son help, and I couldn't get him help. And I end the book, and it was interesting. I'll tell you a little insight. When I did my prison book, I kept myself out of it. With this book, I tried to write it keeping myself out of it. I actually was not a character in this book. And the publisher said to me, we're not going to print it. They said, it's like a wagon wheel. Mental illness is at the center, but you have all these spokes. You have this character here, Ted Jackson. You have this character here, Al San Collier. You have your son, but you stay out of it. It doesn't make any sense. Nobody can follow it. And a good friend of mine said, Pete, you have to be the character. You have to take people on a journey. All good writing takes readers on a journey. And hopefully you introduce characters, you introduce drama, and you introduce conclusion, and hopefully you introduce some kind of redemption. He said, you need to do that. You need to apply fiction to this book. And so then I became a character and went through it in that manner, and it seemed to coalesce and pull it all together. My book ends with a happy ending. My son and I are having steak. He seems like he's doing well. Everything's great. We're going to move on with life. 2 years after he got off his probation ended, he stopped taking his meds, and he started getting sick. Now, I'm going to tell you this. I'll try to be real brief here because I know you have questions, and I tend to ramble. I knew he was getting sick. I called the crisis mobile response team and said, please come. My son's off his meds. He needs help. They said, is he dangerous? I said, no. And they said, well, we don't come if he's dangerous. The night he became violent, the night I didn't have to lie, I called that same dispatcher. I said, my son is violent. And they said, well, wait a minute, is he dangerous or violent? And I said, he's violent. And they said, oh, we don't come if they're violent. Call the police. The police came. They shot my son twice with a taser, hogtied him, and took him away. Now, stop and think about that. And your question prompted this response. I'd written a book about our mental health system. I'm not personally wealthy, but I live in one of the wealthiest counties in America, Fairfax County, Virginia. Average income, household income is $150,000 a year. I had connections with Mike Wallace and Washington Post and news organizations. I couldn't get my son help even after doing all that. So what chance did somebody who doesn't have those connections, I mean, that's the reality we're living in today. So you asked me about crazy, you asked me about the book. In the 6 years since then, my son has been through many other incidents, and you know, the story continues. It doesn't just end because of a happy ending by an author.
Well, and I was thinking that as I read it, because some of the people who don't have a family life, who don't have perhaps the personal income behind them, are people you saw
absolutely
in the jails and prisons that you visited.
Yeah.
And we see what happens.
Yeah, and I can guarantee you, I don't know if anybody here from the legal community, but if Fayetteville is anything like most communities, you got 16% of your people in jails and prisons who are there not because they're psychopaths, but because they have a mental illness, untreated mental illness. They've been picked up for trespassing. They've done something stupid, and there's no safety net, and so they end up. I did run a few figures before my speech last night, and one of the statistics about Arkansas that struck me was that if you get in a situation like mine where your son or a loved one has a breakdown like mine did, the chances in Arkansas of that person ending up in treatment versus ending up in jail are 3-1 in favor of jail. And that's actually low. In some states, it's 6, 7, 8-1.
Well, as you point out in the book, not much good is going to happen there. These are prisons who may have a doctor on staff, maybe a doctor and a part-time doctor. And the doctor-to-patient ratio is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, 12 seconds?
Yeah.
That you can spend with a patient?
Well, let's look at Arkansas again. See if I can remember these statistics. You have about 890-some psychiatric beds in all your hospitals across the state, which is good. You should have about 50 beds per 100,000. You have 6 beds per 100,000 people, so it's not really that good, but you do have 890-some psychiatric beds in public and private hospitals. You have 3,400 people just in your prison system who have a severe mental illness. So even if all those people are kicked out of your prison system, and there would be no place for them. And if you want to really compare apples to apples, your Arkansas State Hospital has about 96 beds for forensic patients, people involved in criminal justice affairs. So you have 36 times more people in your jail, in your prisons, than you have beds for psychiatric patients in your state. And that's not counting county jails. And if Arkansas is anything like Virginia, and hopefully you're ahead of us, we don't even know in Virginia how many people we have in our county jails because they don't ask, and nobody's trained. And so, you know, you can be stuck in a county jail somewhere, be psychotic. You'll come in on a trespassing charge. You'll become even more ill. because of the environment. You may take a swing at an officer or do something more egregious. You get charged with another crime, and all of a sudden you're stuck in this system and can't get out.
You talk about in the book, and for the benefit of people who haven't read the book, let's talk a little bit about deinstitutionalization.
Sure.
You had a period in the middle of the last century when there were state hospitals.
Right.
And by all accounts, most, if not all of them, were dreadful. Popular fiction, there was the Joan Crawford movie, Snake Pit.
Right. Right.
And there was a movement to change things. And it seems like through a confluence of good intentions, penny-pinching, and ignorance, the situation was either static or became worse because now people who might have been in horrible state hospitals were now being shipped to prisons or jails.
What you discover is that this history of mental illness is a history of money. And what happened was Dorothea Dix in the 1800s visited a Boston jail, saw that people were freezing. There was a part of the jail that had no heat, and she went to the jailer and he said, "Oh, those are lunatics. They don't feel the cold. They don't need heat." And she started preaching that people with mental illness needed treatment, not punishment, and she got 33 states to build hospitals, and that sounded fabulous. But over the next 50 years, these people were a low priority. And hospitals became dumping grounds. They became poorhouses. And so what happened then was, in fact, in 1960, in Oklahoma, my native state, there was a newspaper expose, and 60s weren't that long ago for some of us, okay? We still remember the 60s, okay? I say that to my kids, and they go like, "Oh, that's ancient history." I'm going like, "No, I remember this." They called them, you know, they said they were worse than Nazi concentration camps, okay? So there was this movement, civil rights movement, transferred to mental illness, and they said, you shouldn't get arrested if you have mental illness. You shouldn't be stuck in a place and have a ice pick shoved up under your eyelid and your brain scrambled. You should have a right to say, you can't do that to me. And they targeted commitment because the lawyers involved in this thought that commitment was awful, that no one should ever be forced into a hospital. And so you had this civil rights movement that made it almost impossible to get people in these places. And then Uncle Sam came in and basically said, we want to shut these places down. People belong in the communities. John Kennedy's great community mental health. And so everybody said, great, let the feds take care of them. We pushed them out the door. We elected Ronald Reagan. No offense to Ronald Reagan backers. We said, cut the government. I'm giving you the simplistic view. He began cutting the programs, we said. So you had this community system that's never been properly funded. In Virginia, where I live, Fairfax County, one of the wealthiest counties, if you have a mental break right now in Fairfax County and you call up the county and say, I need help, do something, they'll tell you there's a 2-week wait before you can see anybody. And there is a 6-month wait to get somebody who actually looks at your case, a case manager, doesn't just put a Band-Aid on, and an 18-year wait to get into any kind of housing. So that's where we are today. And I don't know what it is here in Fayetteville. I wish I did. But can you imagine if you had a heart attack right here in the library and somebody called and they said, well, you had to wait 2 weeks before we see anybody? And that's the reality for mental health.
Well, and that goes back to the stigma, because when we all use the term mental illness, but I don't know if we all intellectually think about what we're saying. If I were to have a stroke or a heart attack right now, you'd have instant help. But so much of our framework still doesn't think of mental illness as illness like that. And until that is challenged.
And Kyle, there's a reason for that, and that's really an important point. I'm glad you brought that up. We often think that people who have mental illness, it's a moral character flaw, they're faking it, they're just lazy. And part of the problem is, and I didn't know this when I wrote my book, but I later learned it rather quickly, is we don't have any biomarkers. We can't, if you break a leg, it's obvious you broke a leg. We don't have any tests that go, oh, you have schizophrenia, oh, you have bipolar disorder, oh, you have borderline. These are clusters of symptoms described by the patient that the doctors get together and say, hey, guess what? It's not normal to hear voices telling you to kill yourself, so you have a thought disorder called schizophrenia. It's not normal to wake up in the morning and be so depressed you can't get out of bed, and then by nightfall think you're God's gift to all women, and you're running around charging bills thinking you can do, that's bipolar disorder, you must have a mood disorder, and then all these between. So we have our own human frailty saying, this is odd behavior, and of course that irritates people. There are people who don't think mental illness exists. And I found out, wow, even in the own mental health community, you have groups of people who say, look, I have a mental illness, but I'm not arrested. I don't break the law. If they get arrested, then that's their fault. Don't classify me as one of those people. So it was eye-opening.
We have this thin line, and you went through this with your son, where there are civil liberties, civil rights. And if your son was 25 at the time when the
22,
right, when the, but an adult,
right, absolutely.
And if he doesn't want, if he's not a danger and he doesn't want to take medicine, he doesn't have to.
That's right.
So here you are, his father. I can't imagine seeing, knowing he's ill, but your hands are tied. And it, again, it goes back to this good intention from sometimes 50 years ago to protect people.
That's right.
You know, people get the image of one flew over the cuckoo's nest.
That's right.
So how do
it's not only are you not allowed, you're the enemy.
Yeah.
You literally, if you don't think, if you're a parent and you take your son into most hospital settings, they will want to separate you. They will accuse you of just trying to dump your child there. I had a judge tell me that. They will be suspicious of you. They will blame you. We're not that far away from the schizophrenic mother, the idea that mothers cause schizophrenia by dressing their boys in dresses, you know, I mean, just ridiculous. And until we can prove that these are biological and genetically based illnesses, we're going to run into a lot of that prejudice. So not only do you run into hostility, but you run into a system that has, by design now and starvation of funds, is a total triage system. If you are absolutely at the bottom, you can probably get help. But they want you to get there. They want you to become dangerous. They want you to be homeless. They want you to be the person who's completely incoherent and messing in his pants before they want to intervene. And that's partly due to the fact that we don't have any facilities.
You write about the gentleman that you first met in the Miami prison who was in. He gets out. He wants to go fishing. He discovers this video cassette. And you take us through what starts out as a day for any of us, yeah, and suddenly he's back behind bars because there's nothing, the system has nothing else to do.
Right. Ted Jackson's an interesting character because he actually wanted to get better, and he actually didn't mind taking meds. In fact, if you read the book, you'll see at one point he gets scared, and he like quadruples his medicine, and he's taking these strong antipsychotics that would have killed most of us. But he's one of these people we know, and there's some debate about this, but the National Institutes of Mental Health says that about 85% of people can be helped by medication. And we know if we add other services in, and other ways of treatment, that we can reach a majority of people who have mental illnesses. They can recover, they can live relatively normal lives, you know. I mean, there are probably people in this room right now who have a mental illness who you would never suspect. I mean, there's a lot of people with mental illness who don't end up in jails and prisons. But he wanted to get better and he couldn't. And that's something that really upsets me, because after years and years and years of people with mental illness being told, you'll never get better, you need to be locked up, you need to be put away, you can't accomplish anything, we came up with the recovery movement. And we now believe that everybody can recover. And that's wonderful, because if you don't have hope, if you don't believe you can recover, then you never will. But we're abandoning people who aren't going to recover. And that's heresy to say right now in the mental health world. But I've met people in the jails and prisons who, by God, getting them out and getting them better is going to be extremely, extremely difficult. And they may never get better. And we have abandoned those people because we don't want to believe they exist.
So many of these people who are sick, who end up in jails, in prisons, whether it's C-Wing or wherever, the people that have any authority over them at all have little to absolutely no training.
Yeah.
And there are training programs available. And the best of those trainings start to change things, because people who go through them, whether they're police officers or correctional officers in the institutions, change how they view these individuals.
Yeah. Crisis intervention training for police officers. Police officers see more people with mental illness than psychiatrists do.
Right.
And that not only changes your outlook on these people, but it changes whole departments, it changes communities, because once you have a CIT in force, then the officers say, well, why am I taking this person in the emergency room where they're just going to turn them loose for 2 hours? Why don't we have a crisis center where we can drop them off, where they can be channeled into work? Or why don't we have a mental health court where a judge knows these people need treatment, they don't need punishment, it's not going to do any good to lock them up and then turn them loose and lock them up and turn them loose. So let's get them geared into services. Let's find housing. Let's find jobs. Let's find whatever programs they need to improve and benefit from their lives. Why don't they want to take medicine? You know, my son I said last night, my son's had 7 psychiatrists. Only 2 have bothered to learn anything but his name and symptoms because, you know, their job is to stick a pill in his mouth. Well, treating the mind requires treating the heart. So that is exactly right. That's how you start. And the way I do it, here's what I learned on the trail, is if you have a county commissioner, if you guys have some great political leaders here, if I go in and I say, you should fix your system because this is just wrong, they're going to say, thank you very much, Mr. Early. And then right after me, somebody's going to come in and say, you know, our schools are overcrowded and we need to do something about that. And then many people are going to come in and say, you know, the traffic around here is just getting ridiculous. And, you know, we got to do something about that. And on our priority, what always happens is mental illness, especially people mentally ill in jail, are going to be at the bottom. So what you have to do, what I try to do, is go in there and say, look, this person who's sitting in your jail is costing your community $30,000, $40,000 a year, and they're not getting any better. We can help them for half that price and get them better and turn them into productive citizens. I think that's the sales pitch we got to use. But the bottom line is people with mental illness are never going to be the political force that other subjects carry.
The advocacy is just not there.
We don't have votes and we don't have money. Now, there's a way to change that. And the way to change that is to broaden the definition of mental illness. AARP should be involved in this. Sheriff's Association should be involved in this. Religious groups should be involved in this. If you have a mental illness, you touch almost every aspect of your community. It's not just a mental health problem. It's a community problem. And if you start looking at it as a community problem, then it has a lot more clout.
Pete Early is the author of several books, including Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. He was in Fayetteville earlier this month as the featured author of this year's One Book, One Community, facilitated by the University of Arkansas. Our conversation was recorded at the Fayetteville Public Library as part of the annual event, The Gathering of the Groups, which is a partnership between the library and many area book clubs. In a moment on this Day After Thanksgiving edition of Ozarks, another conversation from this autumn that we haven't yet aired. Singers and songwriters Eric Brace and Peter Cooper came from Nashville to Northwest Arkansas to play a couple of shows recently, and they played some music inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio as well. That's next on this brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. This autumn, Peter Cooper and Eric Brace came to Fayetteville from Nashville to play a couple of shows, including a Friday night happy hour session at Kingfish just off of Dixon Street. They've played and written songs together, apart, and as parts of bigger combos. Their latest CD is titled The Comeback Album, and Peter Cooper's just-released solo CD is called Opening Day. During their visit to Northwest Arkansas, they also came to the Furman Garner Performance Studio to talk about songwriting and to play music. Not only do they write songs, but they've also written about writing songs. Peter is a music journalist with the Nashville paper, The Tennessean, and Eric covered music for The Washington Post. I asked them if interviewing musicians helps them become better songwriters.
Yes, it can. It's a secret weapon of sorts. I get paid to attend songwriting school, basically. You sit down with Kris Kristofferson and Tom T. Hall and ask them how they do what they do and soak up the lessons. So it's really an unfair advantage. I should be a much better songwriter than I am.
That's a good point. Yeah. But it's true. I mean, what he says is that we do get to interview people, and I don't do it anymore, but I did from 96 to 2003 in the Washington Post. And I got to call up whoever I wanted, whoever was coming to town, and just interview them. And you get to hear people like Rodney Crowell say things like, I really struggled with my voice until I realized that I had to write songs that only Rodney Crowell could write. And that was kind of a revelation. You didn't have to write standard Moon June songs. In fact, you shouldn't. You should write songs that are the only kind of thing you can do. So it helped me find my voice as a songwriter.
It's an interesting point. That I know you
you, Peter, have defended Nashville because it has become hip for some people, Robbie Foulkes and people, to just say that, you know, Nashville is a horrible place.
Well, I love Robbie Foulkes. First of all, he's a,
and I do too.
For those who don't know, he's a marvelous singer songwriter, and he had a song based on his Nashville experiences that that I find particularly funny. But when we say Nashville, it's kind of, what are we talking about? The Nashville that I know and love is the one where you see John Prine in the parking lot at the Target, and you see Emmylou Harris at the consignment store, and you see incredibly inspiring, creative people at the coffee shop every day. And just because there's somebody in Nashville made a record that you didn't enjoy when they played it on the country station, that has nothing to do with the rest of it. You know, it's like saying you don't like Nashville because of something you heard on the radio is like saying you don't like New York City because you think Donald Trump's kind of a jerk.
Right. Well, and, you know, Nashville has, for decades now, had some of the greatest musicians.
Yes.
You could call up Chet Atkins, and he's there. Floyd Kramer, or, as the case may be, Lloyd Green.
Yes. It is an extraordinary place, and it's the reason why I moved there from Washington in 2004, because you really can call up Lloyd Green and say, let's make a record, or in our case, which we've done, Marty Stewart or Duane Eddy. And, you know, the people that complain about the commercial country music that comes out on those radio stations, and I do, I complain about it a lot, you have to remember that it's a company, major label record companies right now are just merely making soundtracks to advertisements, and they're just cranking out widgets, and they're trying desperately to stay alive and make a buck. But the people that we hang out with, people like Tommy Womack and Todd Snyder and Kevin Gordon and folks like that, Elizabeth Cook, they're just trying to write a great song. And that's two different endeavors. It's like we're making widgets and we're trying to create a timeless song. They're very different things.
The latest album that features the two of you, the comeback album, the first song, which is Ancient History, name drops a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Two I want to bring up. Sid Bream, who you sing was Safe at Home back when the last time the Pittsburgh Pirates were good.
That's right. Are you a Pirates fan?
No, but I'm a baseball fan.
Okay.
And I remember that game vividly.
Okay.
Because Sid Bream was the slowest person in Major League Baseball.
Slowest person in human history. He still managed to beat the throw.
And then you also mentioned Dick Trickle, who was a NASCAR driver.
Yes.
The idea behind the song, I didn't write it, so I'm surmising, is that you are who you are now, but you don't know who you're going to be in the future.
Well, Peter had an idea when he was hearing a story told about Jerry Jeff Walker, and that kind of sent him down the path.
Yeah, actually, somebody was trying to convince Todd Snyder, our friend, that his hero, Jerry Jeff Walker, was kind of a fraud because he was actually raised in upstate New York, not in Texas. He's known now as the Texas Troubadour guy. But his name isn't even Jerry Jeff Walker. So this person was like, his name was Ronald Crosby, and he was from New York. And he's not Jerry Jeff Walker from Texas. He just invented that one day. And Todd was like, he invented that? He's really my hero. So the notion behind the song is that we're what we are today, and if we want to be something else tomorrow, that's just fine. And it's a kind of a laundry list of people who, created their own destiny, which is impossible, actually, because if it's
right.
Your destiny,
I know,
if you believe in destiny.
Don't you hate that in the sports talk shows? Like, well, the team's got their destiny
right.
In their hands.
They're in control of their own destiny. Right. No, not if you buy into the destiny thing. You know?
It's true.
Can we hear that song?
Yes.
Oh, it'd
absolutely.
Be great. And pay attention to 2/3 of the way through to Warren Mahatchik. I just want to say you guys should Google Warren Mahatchik.
Yes.
For a man who lived an extraordinary life.
Yes, we went into an antique store / junk shop in New England one time and saw these fish on the wall that had been caught in 1984 by Warren Mahatchik, and we then looked him up and found out he may be the most astounding athlete of our time.
Cassius Clay was Muhammad Ali. Bill Brown was Lovin' Dan.
Donnie Fritz was Funky Donnie Fritz. Funky Donnie Fritz was the Alabama leaning man.
James Smith was LL Cool J.
Roanoke, Virginia is the Star City.
Harold Grange was the Galloping Ghost.
Harold Jenkins was Conway Twitty. It is what it is, not how it's gotta be. From my point of obstructed view, you are who you are, not who you're gonna be. Every passing moment is ancient history.
Ronald Crosby from New York State was a native Texan named Jerry Jeff Walker.
Gene Chandler was the Duke of Earl. Lucille Lucerne was
Joan Crawford. George Herman Ruth was Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth was the Sultan of SWAT.
Ninja Ted was Judo Jim. The Dig Dug champion was Tommy Gillette. It is what it is, not how it's gotta be. From my point of obstructed view, we are who we are, not who we're gonna be. Every passing moment is ancient history.
Irvin Johnson was Magic Johnson. Larry Bird was a French Lick Hick. Richard Stark, he was Ringo Starr. Richard Nixon was Tricky Dick.
Dick Trickle was a race car driver.
Really, he was a race car driver.
A talented and popular race car driver.
Richard Anderson was Agent MacGyver.
Francis Gum was Judy Garland. Sid Bream was Save at Home.
The secret sauce was Thousand Island. The eighth world wonder was the Astrodome.
Amelia Earhart was an aviatrix.
Warren Mihatchik was an angling champ.
Frederick Douglass was an abolitionist.
They put his face on a 5 cent stamp.
It is what it is, not how it's gotta be. From my point of obstructed view, we are who we are, not who we're gonna be. Every passing moment is ancient history. Oh, you are who you are, so who you're gonna be. Every passing moment is ancient history.
Thank you. It's great. Fair to say, I think that's an empowerment song.
In a way, it is, sure.
I mean, whatever you are now, if you want to be something different, better, you can be.
You can be. So within reason. I doubt I'm going to make an NBA team next year. But
I know. There is a danger, you know, when kids are growing up. It's like, you can do anything. Right. You can be anything you want to be. It's
not so much.
Not, yeah.
Yeah, it is meant as an empowerment song. And people just kind of... Sometimes people get into a rut and think they've got to stay there, but they don't.
You or both of you have DJed on WSM?
Yes.
We have. We have a periodic, about every month or two, we get to go on and do a show, and Peter curates it and comes up with some songs. And we usually do a theme, sort of like One Degree of Separation from, say, Tom T. Hall or Emmylou Harris or people like that.
WSM?
Yeah. Yes.
I mean...
That's the big one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
6:50 a.m. the legend.
Most famous country station there is, and it's just such an honor and a thrill to get to go on there. It feels like you're being entrusted with something. So that's the one time we really work hard not to mess up.
Red Beat Records
Yep.
You and your wife?
That's right. And Lindsay Hayes is our label manager. And we started it when I moved down to Nashville. And, I was moved down there with my band Last Train Home, and I thought surely some label will want to sign us on. And strangely enough, nobody did. And it was at a time when all the labels were kind of collapsing. And
I was going to say it's not exactly a get rich quick scheme.
No, not at all. And
yeah,
so we were
misinformed.
I figure, hey, we'll just start our own label and get rich really quick. But in fact, that hasn't happened. But it has given us the leeway to do pretty much whatever we want. And like signing crazy people like Peter Cooper. And we put out Peter's 3 solo records. We put out 3 of our duo records. There's a woman in South Carolina, Fasu Starling McLean, who was a great singer that was in Peter's hometown of Spartanburg. And he produced her record. She used to sing on all those 1970s Emmylou Harris records, singing harmony. We've done a few East Nashville samplers, compilations, and some Last Train Home records. And we've kind of helped a bunch of other Nashville songwriters along with some of their releases too.
Well, Peter, your latest solo CD, Opening Day, has been out about a week or so.
Yeah, a couple weeks. That's right.
Okay, we've heard you sing Sid Bream. We've heard you sing about Babe Ruth. There's Ron Santo on the back of this CD.
Yes,
you on the front.
Me on the front as an 8-year-old at my first Major League Baseball game.
Folks, he is so cute, and if you don't like the music, you should buy the record just to get that dang cute little boy picture.
It's a picture of me when I was young and had hope and things like that. Rick Camp was on the mound for the Braves that day against the San Diego Padres. Randy Jones on the hill for the Pods.
I'm betting that you are not reciting that from total memory, that you actually did a little research on that game.
No, I remembered all that and then did the research for the liner notes to my album and found out that my memories were correct.
Okay.
Bob Horner was a rookie. He signed an autograph for me that day.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Do you mind if we hear a song from Opening Day?
I would. Yes, in fact.
You
do
mind? Okay.
Yeah. No, okay. All right. Let's do the title track. It's the saddest song I have about hope. I wrote this song right as my son was being born 3 years ago, and he was just perfect at first. And he was born at the beginning of the baseball season, and my team was just perfect at first, and neither of these things lasted particularly long. And he's a good boy, but perfect, that's perfect's a tough order. The odds are on the odds on favorites. They can kill you with a murderer's row. They got a young phenom calling home to mom and saying, watch, I'm gonna put on a show. They can hit for power, they can steal a base. They got a crafty skipper with a poker face. They're gonna race away with a pennant race. A couple of breaks, we might take fourth place. A couple of breaks. All's well that ends well. Around here things don't end well. But we're tied for first with a whole summer left to play. The fall breaks kind for the lucky ones. Winter comes even to the champions. Keep the aftermath and the epitaph. Give me opening day. I've been coming since before I remember. I've seen the pictures to prove that it's so. The season's design will knock your heart out of line and lay it on you when you're laying low. I have seen more big names than you could name. I've seen a whole lot of dreams when they pull up lame. Sad September is a crying shame, but won't you take me out to the new ball game? All's well that ends well. Around here things don't end well. But we're tied for first with a whole summer left to play. And the fall breaks kind for the lucky ones. Winter comes even to the champions. Keep the aftermath and the epitaph. Just give me opening day when it feels like summer in the springtime. Like morning in the afternoon. But we are weak up the middle and dull at the corners. And the dog days come too soon. Too soon. I guess my father was the first to teach me that my mother never understood that it is not fair, the deal ain't square. All you can do is just to try to make good. You know the players will always change. Mostly the uniforms stay the same. Just put your picture in a pretty frame and pass the mustard and share the blame. And pass the mustard. All's well that ends well. Around here things don't end well. But we're tied for first with the whole summer left to play. The fall breaks kind for the lucky ones. The winter comes even to the champions. Keep the aftermath and the epitaph. Just give me opening day. Just give me opening day. Just give me opening day.
Well, maybe I'm optimistic to a fault, but I think that's a song that's empowering, too, because there's always another opening day.
There is always another opening day.
Wait till next
year. There is renewal, a new chance for your heart to just be smashed. Baseball, it's designed to break your heart. It begins with all the hope of spring, and then it ends with the chill of fall and the leaves on the ground and the winter ahead.
I should mention, you're Grammy-nominated.
Yeah, which is code, by the way, for Grammy losing.
But you receive a medallion for being nominated.
Oh, you know how it works.
Yeah.
We got the nominees medallion, and we got to go to a big party Saturday night with other nominees like Weird Al Yankovic. Mm-hmm. That was really fun.
Yeah.
And that was fun because everybody was still not a loser yet.
Yeah, it was like the opening day of the Grammys.
That's right. And then Sunday was the Grammys, and that's when everybody's heads kind of fell.
The most exciting part of that whole thing was just that split second before they announced that we lost. Man.
Hey, but we were sitting in a corner of the room where Emmylou Harris was sitting also.
That's right.
And she did come over to you and say, I voted for you guys.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's pretty good.
Yeah. Get Emmylou Harris's vote. There you go.
I mean, I'll take that.
Absolutely.
Can I get her to sign something, you know, affidavit on that?
I voted for you, Emmylou. Yeah. Maybe so.
An affidavit.
Yeah.
We'll see what we can do, Eric.
But that was for you bringing back a Tom T. Hall album, not even a CD.
Yeah, when Tom T. was an A-list country star in the early 70s, he decided that he wanted to make an album for kids, or at least that kids would listen to and understand. And he was known for songs about barrooms and graveyards and all that. He made an album called Songs of Fox Hollow, and it was all about his farm and the animals on his farm. Put it out, wound up having two number one country hits off it. It was something that when I was a child I'd listen to, and my dad would listen to and enjoy it, and my granddad would listen to and enjoy it. And it's just a splendid album and really kind of a brave thing to do if we can imagine – you know, Brad Paisley or somebody these days putting out a kid's record. The record company would not.
Jason Aldean.
Right. Jason Aldean, kid's record would not. The record company would not be real pleased about that. But Tom T. did it, and I always kind of felt like it was a personal present for me even before I met Tom T. Hall. And so that album got to be out of circulation, and Eric and I decided to go to Tom T.'s home studio at Fox Hollow at his farm and re-record those songs with a lot of Tom T's fans, people like Patty Griffin and Jim Lauderdale and Dwayne Eddy and Bobby Bear, all sorts of folks who just love Tom T. Hall. And we had a ball. We went there and sang songs about goats and
Sneaky snakes.
One-legged and all chickens. That. And everybody that we called said, oh, I'm in.
Yeah.
Hey, you want to go to Tom T. Hall's house and hang out with him and sing some of his fun songs? There. Sure, I'm there.
Yeah, so that was what we were nominated for the Grammy for. And for parents out there, it is, I can say this as a parent, it is a rare kids-oriented album that won't drive you insane. There's not a lot of the blip, 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 blips on there. It's real instruments played by real people.
Very few purple dinosaurs.
Nothing in the way of that, and it's all good. Buddy Miller on there singing about Sneaky Snake. I promise you, it's better. It's better for your life. You know, forget the kids.
We're here to make your
investment
world
in your personal.
That's right.
If you got to hear something over and over again, because we have gotten a lot of responses from parents saying, "Man, you know, when kids play songs over and over again, we really like this one over and over again."
Yeah.
So that's really been rewarding to hear. Almost as good as knowing that Emmylou Harris voted for us.
Mm-hmm.
That, along with opening day, Peter Cooper's brand new solo CD can be found at Red Beat Records, as can the comeback album, Eric and Peter together, and all the other Red Beat Records.
Absolutely.
And I should mention that aren't you working on a Gold Rush project?
I am, yeah, and that'll be out in November, actually.
It's a total money grab.
It's
a folk musical about the Gold Rush.
That's
it's
right.
Just
not another one.
Crass commercialism on Eric's part.
I know. Taylor Swift and Jay-Z both wrote one, and so
right.
I figured I better get on the bandwagon. Yeah, that's coming out, and it's just a story that I made up, and a friend of mine, Carl Straub, and I wrote the songs, and we got people to sing it, people like Kelly Willis and Jason Ringenberg and Tim O'Brien and Daryl Scott, and, well, not people like them, those actual people.
Jason, all right.
So yeah. I'm pretty excited about it, and I hope anybody who's going to be around Nashville on November 2nd, they should come out to see it live, and I'll keep you all posted at redbeatrecords.com.
All right. And can we have one more song?
So, Eric, let's do the song Wait a Minute. It was one you and I both, when we were knee-high to a grasshopper, used to go and hear the Seldom Seen, this progressive bluegrass band, do every week when we were in the Washington, D.C. area in high school.
Birchmere in Alexandria, Virginia, a legendary club, and we did indeed. We generally went there about 10 years apart because I got 10 years on you, but the Seldom Seen, turns out, when I moved to Nashville, turned out to be on both Peter and my list of greatest favorite bands ever and most inspiring band ever, and we were lucky enough, we got to know Mike Aldridge over the years, and
Dobro legend.
He agreed to come in the studio to record a record that we did called the Master Sessions, and it's called Master Sessions because Mike is on it, and he's a Dobro master, and Lloyd Green, who's the pedal steel master, and turned out was Mike Aldridge's pedal steel hero because Mike also plays pedal steel.
Yeah, it's the first time they ever got to make a whole album together, and Mike was the real instrumental centerpiece of the Seldom Scene, and then we asked him if we could record this song, and he's said he'd be happy to have that. And we had a third part on the album was recorded actually by country star Kenny Chesney, who is a huge Seldom Scene fan, and who ever since he recorded this with us has gotten to be pretty famous.
Yeah, we're here to help.
He's done well. He's like selling out stadiums now. So, you know, we're happy to give the kid a boost.
2, 3, 4.
Wait a minute. Did I hear you say you're going far away? Try to change it. I can't take the lonely nights without your love. Doing the road, get the music done, and move along. What good does it do? Play songs for her and hear her say, whoa, 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 wait a minute. Did I hear you say you're going far away again? Try to change it. I can't take the lonely nights without your love.
Rolling along, and life's been good to you. And even so, she comes to you late at night. Is the time you hear her say once again,
wait a minute. Did I hear you say you're going far away again? Try to change it. I can't take the lonely nights without your love. Waiting for you 30 days and nights without a rest. I gotta hold on, 25 to go, and once again I hear you say, Did I hear you say you're going far away again? Try to change it. I can't take the lonely nights without your love. Wait a minute. Did I hear you say you're going far away again? Try to change it. I can't take the lonely nights without your love.
Peter Cooper and Eric Brace live in Nashville and were in Northwest Arkansas recently to play a couple of shows, and they promise they will be back to the area soon. Their latest CD together is called The Comeback Album. Peter Cooper's latest solo CD is called Opening Day, and you can learn much more about all of their musical work at the website Red Beat Records, as in the vegetable, Red Beat, B-E-T, Records.
KUAF will host a Christmas-themed show at 6:30 p.m. December 4th at the Fayetteville Public Library. The public's invited to be part of this audience as the Ozarks at Large team will interview local nonprofits about the importance of giving year-round. Other guests include Becca Martin Brown from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers, and musical performances will include Adams Collins Trio, Jones and Leah, and Farmer and the Markets. The event will be recorded, and portions of it will be broadcast during the December 24th editions of Ozarks at Large. It's free, and it's open to the public. Guests are invited to bring non-perishable food items, which will then be donated to the Fayetteville Public Schools Outback Program. More information is available at our website, KUAF.com.
And we hope to see all of you there. Well, not all of you. We couldn't fit all of you into the Fayetteville Public Library, but many of you there Wednesday night for the Ozarks at Large Christmas show taping. If you can't make it, we will have highlights on our December 24th Christmas Eve edition. But it's free and open to the public with a lot of great local music. That's Wednesday night beginning at 6:30 at the Fayetteville Public Library. Mount Sequoia Retreat and Conference Center presents Merry Little Christmas, a musical celebration featuring the Fayetteville Jazz Collective, Saturday, December 7th in the Clapp Auditorium. Show begins at 7 p.m. Tickets and more information, including overnight accommodations and breakfast, available at 443-4531. And this program note, members of the Fayetteville Jazz Collective will be included in our show Monday at noon on Ozarks at Large. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Berryville. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great rest of your weekend.